From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. The New Hampshire primary is 4 days away, and we're going to talk about election security.
It is, in fact, the pillar of our democracy to have public trust in our election process. Without that, our democracy will fail.
We'll take your calls on our Week in Review. We've got the coronavirus in Boston and months of planned MBTA shutdowns.
They need to do that stuff at night when no one riding, so we ain't got to wait and catch shuttle buses. I hate to catch shuttle buses.
And we'll go out with composer Rob Capello, who breaks down Beethoven's first and last quartets and why he loves them.
I've always been interested in what goes on under the hood, you know, unraveling the mystery. You know, I remember when I was in third grade and teacher would say, we're now going to do this classic piece. I was going to say, but what makes it so great?
It's all next on WBUR's Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. We have just 4 days till the New Hampshire primary, and the whole country will watch tonight when seven of the Democratic presidential candidates take the stage in Manchester, New Hampshire, for tonight's debate. Well, Radio Boston's Chris Siderick is in Manchester right now, and he joins us. Hey there, Chris.
Hey, Tiziana.
Okay, so you've been reporting for us from New Hampshire most of the week this week. What's it been like today?
The phrase that keeps popping into my mind as I've gone across the city today is the calm before the storm. Last few days, basically, you couldn't throw a rock without hitting a candidate event or a rally or a town hall or some sort of campaign function. Today, after this morning, it really kind of feels like most candidates have gone into full debate prep mode, gone off the trail. And I think that's probably smart because I've talked to a lot of voters over the last few days, and a lot of them have told me, I'd say the majority have told me, tonight's debate actually will play a big part in their decision for next Tuesday.
Well, it's 3 hours long, so I'm glad to hear that it actually has some import. Listen, earlier today you attended an election security simulation. That's pretty interesting. Tell us about it.
It was called Operation Blackout New Hampshire. So the best way for me to describe it is to call it a war game simulation around election security. It was put on by Cyber Reason, which is a private cybersecurity company. And it involved their staff basically running the event, but they invited folks from local law enforcement, federal agencies, state government. And I was fascinated by the folks who showed up and attended this event. They had officers from Concord Police Department, Manchester Police Department. There was a Secret Service agent there, someone who works IT for the city of Concord, and former Boston Police Commissioner Ed Davis was there as well.
Well, that's a pretty serious group of folks. So what was the simulation like? What was going on?
So they basically split everybody into two teams. You had the red team and the blue team, and they set this exercise in a fictional city on an election day. It's in a swing state, and a swing city could have major impacts on the presidential election. And the red team is essentially trying to undermine the election as a nefarious actor. The blue team is trying to protect it, keep order, maintain the public trust. I want to give you a little taste of kind of what that sounded like. It's basically a collaborative effort. They're sitting around their two tables. Here's an example of the blue team talking. This is Lieutenant Ken Louie from the Manchester Police Department. And he's asking his fellow blue team members if they should reach out to federal authorities for assistance at this point.
Wouldn't we reach out to FBI at this point to at least let them know that the city is clearly under attack?
Yes.
Adversary is under attack. An adversary shouldn't be dealing with this by itself.
Right.
We would obviously involve the FBI and bring their
feds.
Yeah, Secret Service, bring resources to bear in terms of determining who's conducting these attacks.
Okay, so lots of language about attacking there. What sorts of vulnerabilities did the red team attack?
That was one of the really surprising things for me, because I had kind of the normal headline stuff you would think of, misinformation on social media or trying to undermine things at polling locations. But actually, the first thing the red team did was cause traffic jams. They hacked into the city traffic lights, and that actually caused turnout to go way down in the simulation, which was a big problem in terms of election integrity. So, I mean, it was everything from social media. They hacked the local news at one point, phone system, the sewer system even, the power grid. There was a wide range of different methods that the red team was using. At one point, there was kind of a poignant moment. One of the red team members said they could put out misinformation that there was a terrorist attack using radioactive material, have people shelter in place. Former Boston Police Commissioner Ed Davis said you wouldn't really even have to go that far.
just the reports of indicators, radiation mm-hmm. indicators going off, you don't have to wrap it around a terrorist event. You just have to say, this is the information that we have. And I think people are going to say, I'm just going to stay home.
That was actually a big part of the Red Team's focus, was getting people to stay home, which isn't necessarily the first thing you think of in terms of election integrity, but obviously would have a major impact on the results.
Well, and Ed Davis was the police commissioner who shut down the city during the marathon right. bombing, so we know he knows what it means to make people stay home. You're kind of freaking yeah. me out. So what was the purpose of this event, and do you think it achieved it?
I said that was great and terrifying, and everybody pretty much shared my sentiments there. So Bill Keeler, he's one of the senior directors at Cyber Reason. I asked him, is he concerned at all that this type of event actually could contribute to public mistrust, the very thing they're trying to prevent? He said it's more about getting the folks involved in election security to think outside the box so they'll be ready when stuff happens in the real world.
The hope is that we use these opportunities to practice during peacetime to have government agencies on the local level, the state level, the federal level, and law enforcement agencies practice.
So that word practice kind of made a lot of sense as I watched this play out. It makes sense. You got to practice to be good at something, right?
Yeah.
But there were those moments of kind of collaborative effort that created a learning moment for folks. I'm thinking, for example, at one point the blue team was dealing with the fact that they had deployed extra officers to deal with the traffic. Red team responds by putting out misinformation on social media that those officers are there for stop and frisk and increased deportations to try to discourage people from showing up to the polling locations. Two of the police officers basically said, oh, we should just put out a statement, say that's factually incorrect. But Jonathan Smullen, who handles IT for the city of Concord, had a different suggestion.
But I've heard in the past where police departments reach out to minority leaders and get them out into the public.
That's not a bad idea. Mm-hmm. Reach out to your community leaders,
right, because
minority groups.
The minority groups are more likely to trust them.
Yes.
So if they see them interacting.
I like that. Yeah.
So the direction might be have district police leaders contact community leaders.
So, Chris, this is obviously not the kind of stuff that happened in Iowa, and yet listening to you, it makes me feel like I'd want every state to be doing something like this. What are the big takeaways?
Yeah, I mean, it was essentially really drove home the point how hard this is for folks working in law enforcement and state and local governments, because hackers just basically kept throwing stuff at the wall. Again, Bill Keeler, the director for Cyber Reason, told me that's pretty indicative of what real-world authorities have to face. And I got to say, when I was watching some of the local police and state officials' faces during this exercise, they were just shaking their heads and had these kind of exasperated looks. They just couldn't believe all the different vulnerabilities. And afterwards, none of them would go on the record with me to share their thoughts or reactions, which, to be honest, I thought itself was pretty telling.
Yeah. Okay, Chris, hang tight. I want to check in with one of our other reporters for a minute. We're going to turn now to WBUR's Fred Tice. Yesterday, we checked in on the Bernie Sanders campaign after he declared from New Hampshire that he basically won Iowa through the popular vote in that chaotic caucus. But, of course, there's another candidate claiming victory in Iowa. That's former South Bend Mayor Pete Buttigieg. Fred Tice has been following the Buttigieg campaign in New Hampshire all week, and he joins us now from Merrimack. Fred, welcome back.
Hi, Tiziana.
So, Fred, we had Sanders saying, I won the popular vote in Iowa, but Pete Buttigieg saying, yeah, but I got the delegates. So he thinks he's got momentum. How's he trying to capitalize on that?
Well, he's coming up in the polls here. The daily poll from the Boston Globe, WBZ, and Suffolk University now has him at 23%, just 1 point behind Sanders, who's still the leader. And people are packing Buttigieg's events. I was at an event yesterday, where they clearly did not expect so many people to show up. They had people standing room only, but you really couldn't move in this event. It was an event at the American Legion here in Merrimack, and people were trudging through the snow, walking on the street because there were no sidewalks. They had to park like far away at the high school, and they got there.
So what is his strategy for packing them in and getting their votes on Tuesday?
Well, he's really appealing to the moderate voters who might also like Joe Biden or Amy Klobuchar. And at this American Legion Hall yesterday, he really played up his military background as giving him the ability to appeal to people on the left and the right. Let's listen.
I often think about the fact that when I was getting into a vehicle, whether it was taking something across town in Kabul or taking a trip on the open road to Bagram, the people getting in the vehicle with me could not care less if I was a Democrat or a Republican.
So, Fred, how's that?
Go ahead. Yeah.
Well, I was just going to ask you how it's resonating.
Well, so I met a woman at that rally, for example, who had unenrolled from the Democratic Party, so she could vote for Buttigieg in the Democratic primary. I also met this woman who spoke to me whose brother served as a Marine in some of the fiercest fighting in Iraq, and she thought Buttigieg gets the challenges that military families face. By the way, veterans are a big part of the electorate here, more than 10%, which makes New Hampshire one of the states with the highest concentration of veterans.
So, you know, one of the things that I noticed, Fred, is according to the latest Boston Globe WBZ Suffolk University poll, we have this thing where Buttigieg and Sanders are basically mirror opposites of each other when it comes to the age of their supporters. Buttigieg is the youngest candidate but has strong support with older voters. Sanders is the oldest candidate and has strong support with younger voters. Are you seeing evidence of that, and how's that playing out?
Somewhat. I mean, there are a lot of older voters at the Buttigieg events, but I'm also finding a lot of younger voters. For example, this woman that I was just telling you about, she was a young voter, and there were quite a few young voters who were there at the Buttigieg event. And there was the same thing at a Buttigieg event I went to in Concord earlier in the week.
All right. That is WBUR reporter Fred Tice. Fred, I appreciate you giving us time today. Thanks.
Thanks, Tiziana.
So turning back to Chris Sitterick, Chris, just to tie things up, what are your overall impressions of the week up there in New Hampshire?
I think over the week, the two major themes that have jumped out to me. The first is this sense of uncertainty. Uncertainty to the fact that there are so many candidates and folks aren't quite sure who really is emerging as the front runner. But then also directly tied to the Iowa results. Multiple people have told me that coming out of Iowa, they had no idea what to make of this race and where candidates stood against one another, and that's really kind of affected their approach. They're also looking for, the vast majority looking for, either a connection to the voters or empathy or a candidate that gets it or that's real. Lots of different terms for essentially the same concept, and I think that will make a big difference down the final stretch here.
All right, that is Radio Boston's Chris Sitterick. Chris, thanks.
Thank you.
And listeners will be broadcasting Radio Boston live from Manchester, New Hampshire on Monday and Tuesday next week for the primary. Make sure you join us then. Listen, after the break, we're going to do Week in Review. So since it's Friday, that means our panelists are here. And before we go to the break, I want to get their reactions to what we just heard from New Hampshire. Jim Sturgis is here. He's the executive director of the Pioneer Institute. Jim, thanks.
It's good to be with you.
Also, John Carroll, who is WBUR senior news analyst. John, welcome back.
Good to be here.
So let's just take a quick second. I want to get both of your reactions to what we heard from Chris and Fred in New Hampshire. John.
Well, this is the stage where the horse race coverage is at DEFCON 4. The Boston Globe right now has a headline that says, who won the last 24 hours in the presidential race?
Wow.
And the Globe, BZ Suffolk, they're polling every day. And one of the interesting things is Buttigieg 2 days ago was at 19%, but there were 14% undecided in that poll, which is a lot. And you've got that, and you've got the other X factor is the 42% of independents up in New Hampshire who can pick either primary. I don't think that many of them are going to pick the Republican primary. I could be wrong, but I think the Democratic primary is where the action is, and so they'll have a big influence on that as well.
Jim, I saw you nodding.
I agree with all of that. I think New Hampshire voters historically like to surprise people, right? They like to cut against what is what's considered to be the conventional wisdom. The high concentration of veterans, I thought, was a really interesting point because that's something where those voters like to stick together. They have a unique kind of experience, and I think that would appeal to them. I do think that given the fiasco in Iowa, this is the one that matters. This is the one that actually winnows out the field. And for Senator Warren, it could be a really hard hit to her campaign.
So I want to just shift quickly to a couple of other big national stories this week where we had strong local players. We had the State of the Union. The president delivered it on Tuesday night. Seth Moulton walked out. And Ayanna Pressley boycotted it entirely. This is, of course, after Nancy Pelosi, or at the same time that Nancy Pelosi ripped up the president's speech. John, what's your take on these actions by elected representatives here in the Commonwealth?
Well, it's interesting. I don't know that it's unprecedented, but Seth Moulton tweeted out, you know, when the draft dodger started talking about how much he's done for the military, I walked out. I mean, that was just sort of one too many hypocrisies for Seth Moulton. Ayanna Pressley, I think that that she's basically taking the lead in something that is unusual, which is a real action-oriented pushback against Trump. And I think that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez joined her in boycotting, and I think that we may see more of that kind of thing going forward.
Jim, we heard a lot of cries about lack of decorum and appropriateness in any of those choices and some of the other ones that night, including Republicans chanting 4 more years during the State of the Union. What do you think about this decorum question, especially as it relates to our legislators?
I agree with it. I think the issue is, look, we know that Trump is a petulant child, a narcissist, and all the other things that give people great joy to say about him. Sadly, I think nothing that he did in his post-acquittal press conference, grievance fest, whatever that thing was, surprised us. That should bother us. But I think, you know, the whole idea, I think, that the Democrats once upon a time did say, though I never really believed this, but to be honest, when they go low, we go high. This is when he goes low, we become like him, and we're petulant children just like he is. Now, is there justification for it? Sure. Who started this? Sure. Whatever people want to say, that's fine. But I think about when I raise my kids, the way I talk to them about how to behave, and this is we're in a bad place, and that's not news to anybody.
So somebody who, go ahead, John.
I was just going to say, the other thing is you can't out-Trump Trump. You'll never beat him. You know, Marco Rubio found that out. A whole bunch of people found that out. And, you know, Nancy Pelosi ripping up the speech, I'm sure that was cathartic, but it's just more ammunition for the Trumpiacs. And basically, when he gets you to play his game, he's right where he wants to be.
All right. So one person who was a strong public figure in Massachusetts did not play his game this week, and that is former Massachusetts governor and now senator out of Utah, Mitt Romney, who voted to impeach President Trump on the first article, the abuse of power. Reactions to Mitt Romney? Either of you?
I got a nice email from Mitt Romney yesterday. I have to admit, a lot of people got a nice email from Mitt Romney yesterday talking about
variety,
his decision and linking to his speech. But here's the beginning of the last paragraph. I hope that with impeachment now behind us, the Senate can get back to the critical work at hand. And all I have to say to that is the Lord loves an optimist. I just don't see that happening.
Jim, how about you?
So, yeah, I mean, I think like this is a Mitt Romney is a good indication of where we are. 2 weeks ago, he was no hero to anyone. All of a sudden, he became a hero to people who loathed him just 2 weeks ago. That's kind of, again, where we are as a country. I think on the merits, he stated his case well, and he stated in a heartfelt way. He landed where I would have landed on one count. I think he sided with the Dems. On one count, he did not. I think that's also the correct decision. He made distinctions. He actually said the State of the Union had some positive things in that. And I think people who watch the State of the Union, this is my problem with the Democrats' reaction to it. When he's talking about low unemployment for a variety of different subpopulations, when he's talking about school choice and opportunities, that people couldn't clap for that. I mean, it just makes the Democrats look uncaring and out of sync with what people are actually thinking about. These people were doing the bread and circus stuff in D.C., notwithstanding.
Okay, so John Carroll, WBUR Senior News Analyst, Jim Sturgis of Pioneer Institute. Stick with us. Listeners, we're going to take your calls on the Week in Review after the break. We'll talk about the coronavirus in Boston and the MBTA's planned shutdown for repairs. 800-423-8255. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston's Friday Week in Review. I'm Tiziana Deering, and still with us here in Studio 3 is John Carroll, WBUR Senior News Analyst, and Jim Sturgis, Executive Director of the Pioneer Institute. Thanks for being with us, gentlemen.
Thank you.
And we're going to talk now about the coronavirus in Boston. Bostonians seem to be having a range of reactions to the outbreak and to the first confirmed case of the virus here in Massachusetts this week. Listeners, what's your take? Are you worried? Should we be focusing our public health energy on the coronavirus, or should we be focused on the flu? Have you experienced the other side of this virus, which is the prejudice that we've begun to see in corners? Call us, 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Share your thoughts. All right, John, Jim, here is Dr. Paul Bittinger, Chief of Emergency Preparedness at Mass General Hospital, talking with WBUR this week.
Right now, there is no sustained transmission in Massachusetts, in New England, in the United States of coronavirus. And so right now, people's risk of being exposed in their daily lives is vanishingly small.
I'm not sure that's what you'd think from listening to people talk about it. Do we have the right amount of hype going on here or too much?
Well, it depends on where you look. I mean, in some places, there's a real problem with misinformation, and the World Health Organization is really trying to fight it. They call it an infodemic because there's a tremendous amount of misinformation out there. Here in Boston and Massachusetts, I think there is a lack of context, maybe, and a surfeit of fear. And part of that is from the sort of the unknown. So people are essentially not sure what to think about it. And so you tend, human nature being what it is, to start to consider maybe the worst possible scenario instead of a realistic scenario.
Well, I caught the realistic scenario a week ago. I've been out with the flu, which you can hear.
That's why we're on the other side of the
table.
That's
right. So, Jim, the flu is in full swing. Have we mangled the narrative here? Are we focusing on the wrong thing? Or is it important to talk about this way now?
I think it's important to talk about. We're talking about the wrong one. I think I completely agree with what John said. This is sort of the wrong information occurring in a vortex of no information, right? So, look, when you think about risk is a matter of information. You can actually minimize risk if you have information. If you don't have risk, you feel like you're at risk. And given the fact, if you take a look at any of the maps, just a quick thing, if you look at any of the maps where we have seen cases, Africa does not have a single case reported. That strikes me as
the entire continent.
Yeah, that strikes me as highly anomalous given the fact that there are Chinese construction companies all over the place. The other things that bother you are there are 56 million people, I think, who are currently under some form of quarantine within China. Maybe in the context of China, that's not a high number. For any of us, it's a very high number. When you see the people wearing suits that look as if they're about to go into some contaminated site, to the non-doctor, you are worried about that. The fact that the Chinese government is shutting down information worries people. So that lack of information doesn't mean we should go crazy, but it means that we feel deeply at risk. It's what's led Italy to shut down all flights in and out of China. France is doing something very similar. So, I mean, I think the thing that we're talking about that's important is coronavirus we know about, but this is a strain of coronavirus, and we don't know that much about how – we don't know all the details of how it's transmitted, whether it's actually fully respiratory, if it's through touch and all the rest. We think we understand much of it. In that context, where we have a lot of students in Boston – and we're thinking about, we're in the campus of Boston University with a high level of Chinese students, and I work out with them all the time. Mm-hmm. You know, there are reasons to be concerned to think about rational actions. Obviously, that's completely separate from idiots who go and engage in taunting, mockery, and all that sort of stuff.
Well, I do want to pick up on that second thing. WBUR's Adrian Ma and our Common Health team have been reporting on this week. At the parade on Sunday in Chinatown celebrating the Lunar New Year, City Councilor Michelle Wu told WBUR this.
As someone who's Asian American, people are kind of looking a little bit to make just to check. And everyone wants to be safe. Everyone wants to protect themselves and their families. But when in an instance like this, we have to be very careful not to make the assumption, not to let this spill over into assumptions about an entire race of people or people who look a certain way.
And just listeners, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Join the conversation. What is on your mind about the coronavirus? John Carroll, it has spilled over. Lots of reports of racism, suspicion of Chinese Americans and Chinese national now. What do we do?
Well, you know, you try to give people more information so that they don't have some kind of blind prejudice. But, you know, you have to understand that some of this is baked in. And so this is just the occasion that brings out something that's already latent.
Yeah, we saw something similar with SARS in 2003.
Right. But then, you know, when you look, there's a lot of comparisons to SARS. One of the ones that doesn't get as much attention is the fatality rate for the coronavirus is much lower than the fatality rate for SARS, which was almost 10%. It's about 2%, you know, not great, but they're not really comparable in that way. And I think that that you know, essentially, people like Michelle Wu coming out and addressing the issue directly is something that can help. But I think that the more people come to grips with the fact that 8,000 people in the U.S. have died of the flu since October, as opposed to no one having died from the coronavirus, maybe that calms the fears a bit.
And John, I do want to pick up on that 2%. That's an estimate right now. There has been some conversation that as cases are better reported, that could fluctuate one way or another. I don't know that we know yet.
And it's possible the Chinese government is suppressing information as well.
Yeah. So it's also impacting businesses in Chinatown. WBUR's Adrian Ma reported this. Here's Mei Deng of New Golden Gate Seafood Restaurant in Chinatown, which had no customers when he spoke with her.
After Chinese New Year, normally we are very busy. Right now, it should be at least around 5 tables or something like that, at least. So it's very hard, very difficult time to do right now. I hope everybody can come back and then to eat and then to enjoy.
Jim, we know that after the SARS in 2003, Mayor Tom Menino actually did a public breakfast in Chinatown to bring business back and increase confidence. How should our community be showing up for Chinese Americans, Chinese nationals, Chinese businesses now?
Look, you could do something very much the same thing, but I guess that's a really hard one. I guess, look, the fact is, as the doctor said, there is a vanishingly small chance you're going to contract anything. So it would be good if our public figures did something like that. My fear is this. Look, if you think about the economic impacts of this, the fact that wholesale trips to China by students anywhere in China, business trips anywhere in China are being shut down, means that this thing has filtered out across the entire, all business sectors. That's a pretty difficult thing to turn around. Whether people will follow public leaders on this one, I'm not really sure. Again, I think there are two factors here. One is lack of information, and I'm quite sure, I think, as someone who's observed this stuff around the world, that the Chinese government is suppressing information. But on the other side, we have to also recognize in the past 3 or 4 years, the rhetoric around China in this country has changed dramatically. So you already have people moving in a certain direction. There's much more animus towards China, and that includes by association Chinese people, and then you have this on top of it. That was extremely unhelpful to have all that before.
All right, we're going to move on to the tea, but before we do, I want to grab one listener call on this subject. So last word goes to Dave from Brookline. Dave, you're up.
Hi, Chernobyl. When it first happened, nothing to see. Russian government, you know, didn't say anything until it was too late and the bad things had already happened. I know this is different. I know it could be just nothing still, but do you trust the Chinese communists? I don't.
Okay, thanks for that, Dave. And I think Dave's underscoring, John Carroll, this idea that there's distrust between our governments. We have a lot of rhetoric and concern. And both of you have hit on this subject of information suppression, which we know is going on.
Right. You've got a completely different information system in China. You've got basically an internet that has one big on-off switch. And China can basically turn off the internet, and they also monitor it in a really aggressive way. And people are afraid. So there are people who are afraid to report instances of coronavirus. There are people who are afraid to report deaths. There are people who are afraid to tell the truth. And China was very slow in acknowledging what was happening. The whistleblower who just died, Dr. Li, basically they vilified him and made him, forced him to say, well, this is just a rumor. That set them back as well. So I think distrust is well-founded.
I'm going to shift gears here. Listeners, how about that tea? Because it's going to get worse before it gets better. We've got a plan to include 11-month-long closure for the part of the Green Line from North Station, a month-long closure of the Green Line C and E branches, respectively, and weekday and weekend closures, plus intermittent closures for work on the red, blue, orange, silver lines, and commuter rail. That is every single line. Here is MBTA General Manager Steve Poftek on the new plan.
Fixing the MBTA at our previous pace was not good enough. We needed to build a better T, and we needed to do it faster. So this year, we will be closing the C branch of the Green Line for the month of July, and we will be closing the E branch of the Green Line for the month of August.
Now, Governor Charlie Baker says, hey, we are fitting decades of work into a much shorter time frame, so maybe this is short-term pain for long-term gain. But what do you think? Join the conversation. Is this going to be worth it? How much change needs to happen to tolerate this much shutdown in 1 year period? 800-423-8255. So, Jim, John, I'm going to turn to you. Jim, you first. What's your read on this accelerated plan?
It's precisely what the T should be doing. Should be applauded for it. I do worry about their capacity to manage all of these different projects. I mean, anybody who watches as the folks on the inside knows that some of them are working on 8, 10, 12 projects. Making sure that you're actually doing it well is one thing. Doing it's one thing. Doing it well is a different thing. I think the questions for me are, well, I guess I don't really worry about this having sufficient buses. I think they've shown every single time they've done this, they've been very good and generous in providing that kind of service. But of course, you got to keep an eye on that. I wonder why, I'd love to see an examination or at least an explicit discussion of why the D line's not included here. And I only say this because of the following. Maybe it's in great condition, but if the Alston Turnpike project is going to be coming online in 18 months, 2 years, whatever, that D line, Riverside, is really important to taking people off of the turnpike or driving in. So making sure that is ready to roll with lots of trains, I think, would be really important.
Although as a D line rider, there was extensive night and weekend work done all fall, last
yep.
fall.
And that's going to, I'm sorry to interrupt, that's going to continue through December.
Yep. Okay.
So they are doing something yep. there.
It's just a matter of making sure they can ramp up really fast when the Turnpike Alston project gets done. That's all. And I think the last thing is towns in the area, whether it's Cambridge, Arlington, Brookline, Newton, whatever, they better be ready for micro-mobility, bicycles, scooters, and all the rest, and make sure they figure this out really well, because people are going to be turning to that in the summer.
So, John, this what Jim is saying raises another question, which is, okay, so at some point these repairs are then going to be done. But what does done mean? And will it be enough? Is 2 minutes of time saved on the Silver Line, I think it is, and 4 minutes on some of the other lines enough?
Well, it depends on who you are and when you're riding. Let me just tell you a quick story. I ride the C line, the Cleveland Circle, pretty often. When they shut down street level service last time, you took a bus from Cleveland Circle to St. Mary's, which is the first above ground stop. You got onto a trolley at St. Mary's. And then it went to Kenmore. You got off the trolley at Kenmore and got onto a different trolley to go down to Park Street. So it's like Rube Goldberg is the patron saint of the MBTA.
Nice.
So there's that. There's just the physical issue. People with disabilities are at a tremendous disadvantage. I don't know if you've seen the buses. They're like tour buses.
Yeah, they are. They're like,
you know,
big Greyhounds.
There is no disability access on the buses. The idea of bus lanes is maybe workable in some areas, but it sure isn't workable on Beacon Street.
Or down on the seaport where we're going to have
exactly.
buses above ground for the Silver Line.
Exactly. And the Silver Line can get in and get into the traffic jams with everybody else in the seaport, which are there. I would love to save 4 minutes on my trip from Coolidge Corner to Copley. But I just – they have to do this, but I don't have a lot of confidence that they're going to do it in the most effective and efficient way.
So, Jim, the other question I wanted to ask, we were talking about this today, and we were like, okay, so even us as T riders and you know, community members, we're like, man, they should fix the T. Oh, man, now they're going to fix the T, and it's going to take all this time, and now we're mad. So how does the T win here? Are we just being cranky? Is this or is this kind of, you got to get this right, pressure need to be sustained?
Not being cranky, until the data says that we're arriving on time, have fewer breakdowns and all the rest. This is Povtek's point. He's basically saying, look, this pain is going to reduce a number of unplanned disruptions of service, and they've got to deliver on that. It's to John's point about, I don't have that much confidence. They have to prove the concept. I think in this whole array of projects they're working on, Blue Line, this, that, and the other thing, Red Line, Orange Line. Red Line and Orange Line are the most important projects. They carry the most people, and they could actually, with the changes they're making, if they do it well, they could actually almost double service capacity on the Red Line, serve more people, have more people sit down. That's that would be a proof point for people to actually see improvement.
John, 30 seconds.
One quick addendum. There's a comment from the Boston Globe story about this. Someone said, one good thing about the timing, since they traded Mookie, no one will be taking the Green Line to Fenway this summer. So there is that silver lining.
Do not see that as a silver lining. That's my hubbub if we get to it. And it is time. We have just enough time for our hubbubs. Those are those quick hits, stories, or events that caught our attention this week. John Carroll, you first. What's your hubbubbing about?
My hubbub is about Alan Dershowitz, the human Etch-a-Sketch, who
Dershowitz!
Has spent the last few weeks trying to unsay the things he had previously said about impeachment. So back in the Clinton impeachment, he said, you don't need a crime for impeachment. Now he says exactly the opposite. He goes on television and tells Anderson Cooper, I was correct in both instances. I'm just much more correct right now. Then he had an op-ed op-ed in the Wall Street Journal this week saying that, you know, when I said the Ukraine-style quid pro quo, you know, that's not impeachable if the president thinks that it's in the public interest for him to be elected. Well, that's not really what I said. So Alan Dershowitz is involved in some mind-boggling constitutional contortions here and really in a category all his own.
Well, anytime you can put Etch-a-Sketch into a Week in Review, I'm happy. So how about
happy
you,
to oblige.
Jim?
Well, my gourd, this is the day that I prove that I am the pun king. My hubbub is about Charles Lieber, the Harvard chemist facing 5 years of federal prison for helping China's Wuhan province, them again, allegedly steal proprietary research. Boston Magazine's crack investigatory unit has broken news that, besides his international exploits, Professor Lieber carved out time for pumpkin else that spiced up his life. He was the pumpkin king. He was a champion grower of massive, when I say massive, I mean one-ton pumpkins with ribbons and more from competitions across New England. As they say, go big or gourd home.
Oh, good. All right. You guys
dad humor.
Ow.
When you make me laugh, I cough. You're not supposed to do that. All right. That's Jim Sturgis, Executive Director of the Pioneer Institute. Thanks for being here.
Good to be with you.
John Carroll, WBUR Senior News Analyst. Thanks.
Thank you.
Hey, stay tuned. There's more ahead. I'm Tiziana Dearing. Coming up after the break, we're going to hear from composer Rob Capello, who's going to break it down on Beethoven's first and last quartets. This is Radio Boston. Stick around. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Dearing. Was Beethoven terrifying? To a musician, maybe. Or so composer Rob Capello tells us. He is back in town this week with his series What Makes It Great as part of the Celebrity Series of Boston. This time, Capello is breaking down Beethoven's first and last quartets.
Well, you know, I've always been interested in what goes on under the hood, you know, unraveling the mystery. You know, I remember when I was in third grade and teachers would say, we're now going to do this classic piece. And I was going to say, but what makes it so great? How come it's classic? Just because you told me wasn't enough.
Rob Capello joined us in Studio 3 to take us under the hood of Beethoven's evolving genius, including what made his music so groundbreaking and so challenging. He started by situating Beethoven with some well-known artists of the 20th century.
Picasso, Beethoven, and the Beatles. People who started in one place but become something completely different. And I'm fascinated by people who continually reinvent themselves. And no one reinvented themselves or transformed themselves more than Beethoven. And not only is Beethoven's career about transformation, that's really what makes his music special. You know, I often say that in Beethoven, what it's really about is becoming and not being. In other words, what matters in Beethoven is not what a musical idea sounds like when you first hear it. This is not that interesting. What matters is what an idea can become over time, because in a way it's a metaphor for all of us. What we want is the possibility of transformation. We want to start off as the ordinary people Beethoven starts off with and become this magnificent version he finishes with. So transformation is what interests me in Beethoven, both in his music and in his career.
So you're going to illustrate that for us. Usually when you come on, you play the songs yourself, but you've chosen music for a quartet. Pretty hard to play four different parts with two hands on one instrument. So we're going to use audio clips instead. Tell us about this first clip we're going to hear.
Yeah, the whole idea was, how could I get across this transformation in a single evening? And so I thought I would pick the first and last string quartets because they literally span his entire career. The first one, Opus 18, number 1, published in 1800, is who he was when he was bursting on scene in Vienna, explosive, alive, making his name. And the last one we're going to look at is actually the last complete piece he finished his entire life. So taking these two similar pieces, a quartet and a quartet, two similar movements, in this case, a scherzo movement and a scherzo movement, gets us to see the transformation he underwent at the beginning of his career. We're going to use only one phrase.
Okay, tell me the name of the quartet that this first phrase comes from again.
The first phrase is Opus 18, number 1, his first published string quartet, and here's one phrase from the scherzo. Listen quickly. It only goes by in about 20 seconds.
Okay.
That's it. Now, for Beethoven, that's an idea. In and of itself, you're not going to write home and say, my God, I just heard the most amazing thing ever. That is just the beginning idea. But how does he put it together? The basic idea couldn't be simpler. It's what I'm going to call, it's important you learn these technical terms.
Very technical.
I'm going to call it choppy. That's an idea for Beethoven.
Okay.
Just a long note and two short ones. Long.
Okay.
Choppy, that's it. Now, he always assumes you're really smart, so you only need to hear an idea twice. So the first one is choppy. Then you do choppy higher. Now, what would be horrible and boring to do next? A third choppy one would be intolerable. It would insult your intelligence. But I'll show you what it sounded
offended.
Like. Here's the first one. Second. This would be intolerable.
Stop, it's intolerable.
Stop. So what Beethoven does is he gives you the first two, and then he changes them. So the first one goes like this. Once. Second. But then... So I loved your raised eyebrows. That's what we wanted.
What he did there.
So we'll call this smooth. So now we've got choppy, choppy, smooth. Let's get that in our ear one more time. Choppy, choppy, smooth. Okay, now we've done choppy and we did it choppy. We did a smooth. What would be logical to do to get smooth in your ear? A second smooth. Here's what that would have sounded like. Here's choppy, choppy, smooth, smooth. Choppy, choppy, smooth, smooth. But no such luck. Beethoven is more alive than that. Here's what actually happens. Expect choppy, choppy, smooth, smooth.
I will.
We get choppy, choppy, smooth, but then...
Trilly.
Now, if you're inside, that trill is like the coolest thing you ever heard because it's not smooth.
And or choppy, really. It's like this other
thing.
It's a
Brit, and suddenly it's like a new character in the play. We've got a trill, and now does the trill go up or down? Up. Trill up. But then what do we answer it with? Trill down.
Oh, my.
That's a musical sentence. Now, is loud a surprise? Yes, because everything else has been soft. Is down a surprise? Yes, because we just went up. Now, the entire movement is based on nothing but that. Transformations of choppy, choppy, smooth, trill up, trill down.
Okay.
In the program, you're going to, by the way, have to memorize that.
Well, I'm impressed. This is early, though, and you keep saying, you know, these ideas, nothing particularly brilliant. That sounds kind of brilliant for early in his career.
Even early is brilliant for Beethoven. But over the course of the piece, the whole game is we're going to always start with choppy, choppy, and what comes next is constantly changed. It's all about transformation, always upending your expectations, like the best mystery novel or the best detective show. That's what early Beethoven is all about.
Okay, so your next sound, though, the next cut that you brought us is actually from later Beethoven.
This is now 27 years later. This is the last complete piece he ever wrote. This is from the middle of a scherzo movement, the same movement, and it starts off with, again, a very simple idea, just a scale that's divided between instruments. Here's the scale by itself. That doesn't sound so difficult. It's a scale. Here's what it sounds like in the group.
That is not a scale.
It is a scale. Now, but there's something else going on as well, and that's what it's all about. So you got a cello doing the scale. Then it passes to the first violin. But you've got an accompaniment going like this. Now, it changes on the seventh bar. I'll count for you. One, two, three, four, five, six, seven. That's going to be the whole game. When do we change the scale? If I put it together, you can hear it changing. One, two, three, four, five, six, seven. Now, the whole game is about repeating that scale over and over again, but changing it a different place. The next time it comes in, it changes on the fifth bar. One, two, three, four, five, six, and we're done.
Yep.
Every time it comes back, it's either in a different key, but it's the same tune, but we change in a different place. But then we get the transformation that Beethoven is all about. In the middle of the movement, it comes back one more time. You hear the scale one more time, and then all of a sudden, the universe you know dissolves. You are plunged into the abyss, a passage unprecedented for which no composer had ever given us a hint that this could even be music, a passage of such utter fury and terrifying apocalyptic fury for which you are utterly and terrifyingly unprepared. Here we go. And now back to where we started.
That sounds exhausting. It's overwhelming.
I mean, you have no idea how exhausting it actually is to play.
I can't imagine.
I mean, now, here's the thing about it, though. That little thing that repeated over and over again. You remember our little cello scale started like this. Now, I often say composition is about listening for possibility, hearing possibilities in the ordinary that no one else would have missed. Now, this doesn't sound so spectacular by itself. That's it. He takes just these notes, changes one note and turns it into this, and then plays that 47 times.
47 times.
The whole accompaniment to that apocalyptic passage is the cello and the viola and the second violin over and over fortissimo playing 47 times until Philip Glass and the Minimalists arrived. No one had ever repeated with such fury the same thing over and over again. While they're doing this one little figure 47 times, we're playing this ridiculous melody that's unplayable in the violin. It's barely doable. You know, for Beethoven, when things are really hard to play, it's because he's trying to say something that we couldn't say in normal speech. It's not difficult for the sake of difficulty. It's difficulty because we're trying to communicate something that the instrument itself cannot get across. This melody is ridiculously high.
And that's something the violin plays?
The first violin has to play that above the apocalypse going on underneath.
And do first violinists say this is nearly impossible to play?
It's impossible to play. You know, sometimes I ask them to demonstrate it by themselves, and they look at me like I'm the worst person on the planet. It's bad enough to play it with the other people underneath. When you try to play it by yourself, you're leaping around on the instrument. It is literally virtually unplayable. But Beethoven always said, I don't care about your fiddle. This is what I'm trying to get across. No one had ever let ugliness or this extreme world of emotions into a single piece of music.
Okay, but that wasn't ugly.
Well, it's not ugly, but it's extreme. Put it this way. Beethoven was more extreme than any previous composer. He was like your worst nightmare of a dinner guest. I mean, whenever he would come
in, sounds kind of gangster.
People would ask him to improvise, and he would play these exquisite passages. And just when they were dreaming like White Christmas or something like that, he would bang down the keys as loud as he could and then laugh and walk out. That's the kind of guy he was. The kinds of emotions that his music contained were different than what anyone else had ever written. In a way, it's a revolution socially. It's saying, no longer am I your servant. No longer am I going to give you the polite world of polite classical music. Now it's going to be my inner voice communicating to you, you support me. I am the center of creativity. What my voice is what matters. I run the show. You know, my favorite quote from Beethoven is he says, there will always be 1,000 princes. There is only one Beethoven.
What do you enjoy most about doing this type of performance for audiences?
What I enjoy is watching the light bulbs go off and watching people actually hear things for the first time, because then in a way it's a connection. One of the reasons I did this was oftentimes performance can feel like a monologue rather than a dialogue. And so it's that magical moment when what we're hearing on stage is the same moment that you're actually hearing and getting it. You're speaking the same language that we're speaking. Then we're no longer a me. We're part of a we. The other reason I did this was I was a Yale professor in my 20s. It was my very first job. And it was very fun to be at 24 years old conducting the symphony orchestra.
You're kind of fancy then.
It was very fancy. But then I got an offer to conduct on Broadway, the Tony Award-winning musical. And for 3 months, I tried to do both jobs at the same time. I would teach Beethoven symphonies during the day, take the train to Broadway, conduct the Tony Award-winning musical every night, and then take the train back. And that was where this really started to hit me, because whatever you think about that Broadway music, people get it. They speak the language of those Broadway shows. Not only were they willing to pay extraordinary amounts of money to come, but people got it. Then I would take the train back and do these Beethoven symphonies, and the number of people who got it the same way, who really spoke the language of that music, was infinitesimally small. And I just thought, I don't want to do it if they're not going to get it.
Yeah.
And there was a wonderful quote from Walt Whitman. He said, to have great poets, there must be great audiences. To me, to have great music, there must
be great audiences.
To me, to have great music, there must be great listeners. Yeah. And that's really what the series is about, is creating a world of great listeners.
Right.
And that moment when they're hearing it and you're playing it and we're in the same room really speaking the same language, that music becomes as alive as if it were written today.
Composer Rob Capello will be performing with the Verona Quartet Sunday at the New England Conservatory's Jordan Hall at 3 p.m., That concert is presented by the Celebrity Series of Boston, and you can find more information about it at our website, radioboston.org. And Rob's book is called Listening for America, Inside the Great American Songbook, From Gershwin to Sondheim. That's our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Jamie Bologna, Zoe Mitchell, Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, and Walter Wuthman. Tim Skog is our technical director, with engineering by Renee Marchando. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi, and I'm Tiziana Deering. Join us again Monday from New Hampshire for more Radio Boston.